possible purchases, that in about an hour my hunger was appeased, and I was able to realize my situation fully. During the meal, my uncle was almost merry. He even indulged in a few jokes, very harmless ones, certainly. After dessert, he beckoned me into his study. I obeyed. He seated himself at one end of the table, and I took the other. "Axel," he said, in a rather gentle tone, "you are a very ingenious fellow. You have done me a noble service just when, weary of the struggle, I was about to give up the combination. What wrong tracks should I have got into then? Who can say? I shall never forget this, my boy, and you shall have a share in the glory we are about to gain." "Come," thought I, "he's in a good humour. Now's the time to discuss the glory." "Above all," continued my uncle, "I enjoin upon you the most absolute secrecy, you understand me. There are savants who are envious of me, and many would undertake this journey who will never know of it till we return. Do you think there are so many bold enough to venture?" "Certainly. Who would hesitate to win such fame? If this document were known, a whole army of geologists would rush after Arne-Sagnusum."
"That is just what I doubt, Uncle, for there is no proof of the authenticity of the document."
"What? Didn't we discover it in the book?"
"Yes, and I grant that Sagnusum wrote those lines, but does it follow that he really accomplished the journey? And may not this old parchment be all a hoax?" This last word was rather hazardous, and I almost regretted I had said it. The professor knitted his brows, and I was afraid I had seriously damaged my cause. Fortunately, no remark was made. A faint smile, indeed, was discernible on my stern interlocutor's lips, as he replied,
"That is what we shall see for ourselves."
"Ah," said I, "but perhaps you will allow me to exhaust my stock of objections to the document?"
"Speak your mind freely, my boy. I allow you perfect liberty of opinion. You are no longer my nephew, but my colleague. Go on, then."
"Well, I should like to know at the outset what this Yokul and Snaffel and Skartaris are. I have never heard of them before."
"Well, I have no difficulty in telling you that. I happened just a short time ago to get a map from my friend Augustus Petermann of Leipzig, and it could not have come more opportunely. Fetch the third atlas in the second row of the large library, list G, plate 4.
I got up, and thanks to these precise directions, found the atlas wanted. My uncle opened it and said,
"Here is one of the best maps of Iceland, Handerson's, and I dare say it will solve all our difficulties."
I leaned over, and the professor said,
"Look at this island, composed of volcanoes, and notice that they all bear the name of Jokul. This word means glacierus, Icelandic, and in the high latitude of Iceland, most of the eruptions break out through sheets of ice. The name Jokul applies, therefore, to all the eruptive mountains in the island."
"Well, and what is this Snaffel?" I replied. I hoped he would not be able to answer this query, but I was mistaken. My uncle began again. "Follow me along the western side of Iceland. Do you see Reykjavik, the capital?"
"Yes."
"Well, go up the innumerable fjords on the shore, and stop a little below the 65 degrees of latitude. What do you see there? A sort of peninsula, like a long bare bone, ending in an enormous knee pan."
"A very good comparison, my boy. Now, do you see nothing on this knee pan?"
"Yes, a mountain, which seems to have risen out of the sea."
"Well, that is Snaffel."
"Snaffel?"
"Its very self. It is a mountain 5,000 feet high, one of the most remarkable in the island, and assuredly the most celebrated in the whole world, if its crater leads to the center of the globe."
"But that is impossible," I exclaimed, shrugging my shoulders. "Impossible?" repeated the professor sternly. "And pray, why?"
"Because the crater is evidently blocked up by lava, burning rocks, and because—"
"And what if the crater is extinct?"
"Extinct?"
"Yes.
The number of active volcanoes on the surface of the globe is only about 300, but extinct volcanoes are to be found in far larger numbers. Now, among these last is Snæfell, and the only eruption on record took place in 1219. From that date, the rumblings began to die away gradually, till now it is no longer ranked among the active volcanoes." To positive declarations like these, I had absolutely no reply to make. I had, therefore, to pass on to the other obscurity in the document. "What does this word Scartaris mean? And what have the calends of July to do with it?" I asked. My uncle took a few minutes to think, and I began to hope. But only for an instant, as he soon went on again and said, "What you call obscurity is to me light. This proves the ingenious pains Saknussemm has taken to make his discovery clear. Snæfell is composed of several craters. It was therefore necessary to indicate which one led to the center of the globe. How has the Icelandic savant done it? He has remarked that as the calends of July approached, that is to say about the end of June, one of the mountain peaks, the Scartaris, projects its shadow over the opening of the crater in question. And this fact he states in the document. Could anyone imagine a more exact indication? And the summit of Snæfell once reached, could there be the least doubt which road to take?" Positively. My uncle had an answer for everything. I soon saw all attack against the words of the parchment would be useless. I therefore ceased to discuss the subject, and went on to the scientific objections to the journey. "Well then," I said, "I am obliged to confess the sentence is plain enough and leaves no doubt on the mind. I even grant that the document appears perfectly authentic. This savant has been to the bottom of Snæfell. He has seen the shadow of Scartaris fall softly over the edges of the crater, towards the calends of July. He has even heard legendary tales that this crater leads to the center of the earth. But to believe that he has reached it himself, that he ever made the journey, or came back if he did, no. 100 times no, I say to that."
"And your reason?" said my uncle, in a peculiarly bantering tone.
"My reason is that all the theories of science prove the impracticability of such an enterprise."
"All the theories say so," replied the professor good-humouredly. "Aha! Those tiresome theories! How they hamper us, those poor theories!"
I saw he was making fun of me, but I went on notwithstanding. "Yes," I said. "It is well known that heat increases about 1 degree in 70 feet below the Earth's surface. Now, at this rate, the temperature at the center must be over 20,000 degrees, since the radius of the Earth is about 4,000 miles. Everything in the interior must consequently be in an inflamed gaseous state for metals, gold, or platinum, and even the hardest rocks could not resist such a heat. I am justified, therefore, in asking if it would be possible to get there."
"So it is the heat, then, Axel, that stumbles you?"
"Undoubtedly. If we even only reached the depth of the Earth's crust, we should find the temperature was above 1,300 degrees.
"And you are afraid of passing into a state of fusion?"
"I leave you to settle that question," I said crossly.
"This is what I settle," replied Professor Liddenbrock, mounting the high horse. that neither you nor anyone else knows anything certain that is going on in the center of the Earth, seeing that we scarcely know the 12,000th part of its radius. That science is eminently perfectible, and that each theory has constantly to give way to a fresh one. Was it not believed, till Fourier's time, that the temperature of the planetary spaces was constantly decreasing? And is it not known now that the greatest cold does not exceed 40 or 50 degrees below zero? Why should it not be so with the internal heat? Why should there not be a certain limit beyond which it cannot increase? I could not reply to this, since my uncle now placed the question in the regions of hypothesis. And he went on to say, "And now let me tell you that many learned men, Poisson among others, have proved that if the temperature of the center of the Earth was 20,000 degrees, the incandescent gases arising from the molten materials would acquire such elasticity that the crust would burst like a steam boiler." That is only Poisson's opinion, Uncle, that's all. Certainly, but other distinguished geologists agree with him in thinking that the interior of the globe is neither formed of gas, nor water, nor of the heaviest minerals known, for in that case the Earth's gravity would be twice less. Oh, figures can be made to prove anything. And facts, too, my boy. Is it not unquestionable that the number of volcanoes has considerably decreased since the early days of the world? And if great central heat existed, would it be likely to get less powerful? If you enter the field of suppositions, Uncle, I have nothing more to say on the subject. And I have to say that my opinion is supported by that of very competent judges. Do you remember a visit Sir Humphrey Davy, the celebrated chemist, paid me in 1825? Not the least, since I only came into the world 19 years afterwards. Well, Humphrey Davy came to see me in passing through Hamburg, and among other topics we had a long discussion on the hypothesis that the center of the Earth was in a liquid state. We both agreed that this liquidity was impossible, for a reason to which science can find no reply. "And what is it?" I asked in surprise. "It is this, that the liquid mass would be subject, like the ocean, to the moon's attractions, and that consequently, twice a day, there would be tides which would heave up the Earth's crust and cause periodical earthquakes. But still it is evident that the face of the globe has undergone combustion at some period, and it is allowable to suppose that the exterior crust cooled first, and the heat took refuge in the center." "It is erroneous," replied my uncle. "The Earth has been heated by the combustion of its surface, not otherwise. This surface was composed of a great quantity of metals, such as potassium and sodium, which have the property of igniting by mere contact with air and water. These metals take fire when the atmospheric vapors fall on the ground in the form of rain, and as the water gradually penetrates the cracks in the Earth's crust, they cause fresh fires, which burst out in explosions and eruptions. This is why volcanoes were so frequent in the early ages." "That certainly is a clever hypothesis," I could not help exclaiming. "And Humphrey Davy made me see it by a very simple experiment. He made a metallic ball of those metals, chiefly, which I have just mentioned, which perfectly represented the globe. On this he squirted a sort of fine dust, and the surface began to puff up and get oxidized and assume the shape of a little mountain. A crater opened in the top, and an eruption took place which communicated such intense heat to the whole ball that it could not be held in the hand." Positively, I began to be shaken by the professor's arguments, heightened as their effect was by his usual fire and enthusiasm. "You see, Axel," he added, Geologists have raised diverse hypotheses about the Earth's center, but nothing has been less proved than the existence of great heat. According to me, it does not exist. It cannot exist. But we will go and see. And like Arne Saknussemm, find out for ourselves who is right.
Yes, that we will,
I exclaimed, carried away by his enthusiasm. We shall see, that's to say, if we can see at all there.
And why not?
May we not reckon on some electric light, and even on the atmosphere? For the pressure, as it approached the center, would render it luminous.
Yes,
it is possible after all.
It is certain,
replied my uncle triumphantly. But silence, remember, silence about the whole business. Let no one take it into his head before us to try and discover the center of the earth.
Chapter 7. So ended this memorable conversation. It had put me in a perfect fever. I was quite giddy when I left my uncle's study, and there was not air enough in the streets of Hamburg to revive me. I went along the shore of the Elbe, beside the little stream which conveys passengers to the Hamburg railway station. Was I convinced by what I had been hearing, or was it merely the professor's power that had conquered me? Must I treat this project seriously? Had I been listening to the mad speculations of a fool, or the scientific deductions of a great genius? And in it all, where did the truth end and error begin? 1,000 contradictory hypotheses floated before my mind, and there was nothing I could lay hold of. However, I recollected I had felt convinced, though my enthusiasm began to cool down. But I would have liked to start immediately, before I had time for reflection. Yes, I could have strapped my portmanteau and set off that moment. But I must confess that, within an hour, this unnatural excitement left me. My nervous tension relaxed, and I was able to ascend from the depths of the earth to its surface once more.
"It is absurd," I exclaimed. "It is not common sense. It is not a rational proposal to make to a sensible lad. Nothing of the sort exists. I have not slept well, and I have had a bad dream."
Meantime, I had followed the shores of the Elbe and got past the town. After I came out of the harbour, I took the road to Altona, in obedience to a presentiment which after events justified, for I soon described my little Gräuben, tripping along on her way home to Hamburg.
"Gräuben!"
I shouted in the distance. The girl stopped, rather put about, I should imagine, at hearing her name called out on the public road. A few steps, and I was beside her.
"Axel,"
she said in surprise.
"Ah, you came to meet me. I know you did, sir."
And when she looked at me, she could not but notice how upset and worried I looked.
"What is the matter?"
she said, holding out her hand.
"The matter, Gräuben?"
A few brief sentences told her the whole affair. She was silent for a minute. Did her heart throb like mine? I didn't know. But the hand I held in my own did not tremble in the least. We had gone 100 steps without speaking, and then she said,
"Axel?"
"Dear Gräuben," I replied, "this will be a great journey." I gave a jump.
"Yes, Axel, a journey worthy of the nephew of a savant. It is right for a man to distinguish himself by some great enterprise."
"What? Gräuben, wouldn't you dissuade me from attempting such an undertaking?"
"No, dear Axel, I would gladly accompany you and your uncle, but a poor girl like me would only be an encumbrance."
"Is that the truth?"
"Perfect truth."
"Ah, those women and young girls, female hearts, always incomprehensible. You are either the most timid or the bravest of beings. Reason has nothing to do with you. The idea of this child encouraging me in this expedition
and being willing to go herself, too, even urging me to it, though she loved me. I was somewhat nettled, and why should I not own it, ashamed as well?
Gräuben, I replied.
We'll see if you will say so tomorrow.
Tomorrow, dear Axel, I shall say the same as today.
We walked on together hand in hand, in profound silence. I felt quite worn out by the exciting scenes of the day. After all, thought I to myself, the calends of July are a long way off yet, and many things may happen before that, which may cure my uncle's craze for an underground journey. It was late in the evening when we reached the house in Königstrasse. I expected to find everything quiet, and my uncle gone to bed as usual, and Martha in the dining room with her dusting brush, making all straight for the night. But I had not allowed for my uncle's impatience. I found him shouting and running about among a troop of porters, who were unloading sundry goods in the passage. The old servant was at her wit's end.
"Come along, Axel, pray!" he called out, as soon as I came in sight. "Unfortunate fellow! Here is your portmanteau, not packed, and my papers not arranged, and the key of my travelling bag not to be found, and my gaiters not come!"
I stood dumbfounded. Voice failed me. My lips could scarcely articulate the words.
"We are going, then?" "Yes, unlucky boy! Wandering about instead of being here?"
"We're really going?" I repeated feebly.
"Yes, the day after tomorrow, at dawn."
I could not bear to hear more, and flew to my own little room. There could be no doubt about it. My uncle had been employing his afternoon in getting some of the articles and utensils necessary for the journey. The passage was full of rope ladders, slip nooses, torches, gourds, cramp irons, pickaxes, alpenstocks, mattocks, enough articles to load 10 men at least. I spent a terrible night. Next morning I heard myself called quite early. I determined not to open the door, but who could resist the soft voice which said,
"Axel, dear Axel."
I came out of my room thinking to myself that Gräuben would change her mind when she saw my pale, haggard face and eyes, red with want of sleep. But as she met me, she said,
"Ah, you are better today, dear Axel, I see. Your night's rest has quieted you."
"Quieted me?"
I rushed to my mirror and looked at myself. Well, I must confess, I did not look so bad as I supposed. It was incredible.
"Axel," said Gräuben, "I have been having a long talk with my guardian. He is a bold savant, a man of great courage, and you must not forget his blood runs in your veins. He has told me all his plans and hopes, and why and how he expects to gain his object. He will succeed. I have no fear of it."
"Ah, Axel, it is a grand thing to devote oneself to science. What glory awaits Mr. Liddenbrock, and will be reflected on his companion. When you come back, Axel, you will be a man, an equal, free to speak, free to act, free to—"
The girl blushed, and did not finish the sentence. Her words animated me, but I still refused to believe that we were really going away. I dragged Gräuben off with me to the professor's study.
"Uncle," I said, "is it quite settled that we are to go?"
"What? Have you any doubt about it?"
"No,"
I said, afraid of vexing him.
"Only I want to know what's to hurry us so."
"Why, time, to be sure. Time, which is fast flying, and can never be overtaken."
"But this is only the 26th of May, and between this and the end of June—"
"And do you suppose, you ignoramus, that we can get to Iceland so easily? If you had not gone off like a fool, I would have taken you with me to the Copenhagen office at Liffenders and Co., where you would have learnt that there is only one service between Copenhagen and Reykjavik, and that is on the 22nd of every month."
"Very well."
"Very well. Why, if we wait till the 22nd of June, We shall arrive too late to see the shadow of Skartaris touch the crater of Snaefell. We must therefore get to Copenhagen as quickly as we can, and find out some means of transport. Go and pack your portmanteau.
There was not a word to say, and I went upstairs again to my room. Gruiben followed me. She undertook to arrange and stow away in a little portmanteau everything I needed for the journey. She was as cool and collected as if I had been going on a mere pleasure trip to Lübeck or Heligoland. Her little hands went quickly to work, without the least haste or fluster. She talked calmly, and gave me most sensible reasons in favour of our expedition. She enchanted me, and I felt furious at leaving her. Sometimes I was going to break out in a passion, but she took no notice and went on methodically with her tranquil occupation. At length the last strap was buckled. I went down to the ground floor. All this day philosophical instruments, arms, electrical machines were being brought to the house. Martha did not know what to make of it.
"Is the master mad?"
she said. I made an affirmative gesture.
"And is he going to take you with him?"
I repeated the affirmative gesture.
"Where to?"
she asked. I pointed with my finger towards the heart of the earth.
"Into the cellars?"
cried the old domestic. "No," I said at last, "lower down than that." Evening came. I didn't know how the time went now. "Tomorrow morning," said my uncle, "we start at 6 precisely." At 10 p.m. I fell on my bed like a lump of inert matter. During the night my fears returned in full force. I dreamt of abysses. I was delirious. I felt myself in the iron grip of the professor, being dragged away and engulfed. I was falling down terrific precipices, always getting lower and lower, with the ever-increasing velocity of bodies falling in space. And yet I never reached the bottom. It was one interminable descent. At 5 o'clock I awoke, exhausted with fatigue and emotion. I repaired to the dining room and found my uncle already at table, devouring all that came in his way. I almost shuddered when I looked at him. But Gruiben was there, and I said nothing. I could not. At 5:30, I heard the rattling of a vehicle coming down the street. It was a big coach to take us to the railway station at Altona. It was soon packed with my uncle's luggage.
"And where is your portmanteau?" he said to me.
"It is ready," I replied, turning faint.
"Make haste and fetch it down, then, or you will make us lose the train."
To struggle against my fate seemed impossible. I went up to my room, rolled my portmanteau down the stairs, and followed it immediately. My uncle was just putting the reins of government solemnly into Gruiben's hands. My pretty Firlandaise retained her habitual composure and embraced her guardian passionately, but she could not keep back a tear, which dropped on my face when her sweet lips touched my cheek.
"Gruiben,"
I cried.
"Go, dear Axel, go," she said. "You are leaving your betrothed, but you will find your wife when you come back."
I clasped her once more in my arms, and then took my place in the coach. Martha and the young girl stood at the door waving us a last adieu, and next minute we were dashing along at a gallop towards Altona.
Chapter 8. At Altona, which in fact was only a suburb of Hamburg, commenced the line of rail to Kiel, by which we were to get to the shores of the Belt. In less than 20 minutes we entered the territory of Holstein, and at 6:30 the coach stopped before the railway station. The numerous packages of my uncle were unloaded, weighed, labelled, and deposited in the luggage van, and at 7:00 we took our seats opposite each other in the same compartment. A shriek from the whistle, and we were off. Was I resigned? Not yet. However, the fresh morning air and the constant variety of scene as the train bore us swiftly on
diverted my mind somewhat from its preoccupation. As to the professor, the engine was evidently much too slow for his impatience, and his thoughts were far ahead of it. We were alone in the carriage, but neither of us spoke. My uncle was turning out his pockets and his travelling bag, and investigating everything with the most minute attention. I soon saw that he had secured whatever was necessary for the execution of his projects. Among others, there was one sheet of paper bearing the heading of the Danish consulate with the signature of M. Christensen, the consul at Hamburg, and a friend of the professor. This would give us every facility for obtaining introductions at Copenhagen for the governor of Iceland. I also perceived the famous document carefully stowed away in the most secret pocket of his portfolio. I anathematized it in my deepest heart, and turned away to look out again at the window. The country through which we were passing was a vast succession of uninteresting, monotonous, muddy plains, though tolerably fertile, a country very favourable for making railroads, as it would allow of the straight lines so prized by railway companies. But this monotony had not time to grow wearisome, for in 3 hours from the time we started, the train stopped at Kiel, a few steps from the sea. Our luggage was registered for Copenhagen, so we did not need to trouble ourselves about it. However, the professor looked anxiously after his property, as it was being carried on board the steamer, till it disappeared into the hold. My uncle, in his haste, had calculated so well that we found a whole day would be lost here, as the steamer, the Eleanor, did not sail till night. 9 hours' fever was the result, during which the irascible traveller stormed and swore at the managers of the railways and steamers and the government which allowed such abuses. I had to join in with him when he attacked the captain on the subject, insisting on the furnaces being lighted and the vessel put in motion immediately. The captain merely sent him about his business. But at Kiel, as everywhere else, a day must come to an end. By dint of walking along the verdant shores of the bay, in the heart of which the little town is situated, and roaming through the thick woods, which give it the appearance of a nest among the branches, and admiring the villas, and racing about and fuming, the time passed, and 10 o'clock struck. Clouds of smoke puffed out from the Eleanor, and the bridge shook with the vibration of the boiler when we came on board and took possession of our berths in the one solitary cabin of the steamer. At 10:15, the cable was let go, and the steamer began to thread her way rapidly through the gloomy waters of the Great Belt. The night was dark. There was a fine breeze and a strong sea. Here and there on the coast, lights glimmered. Farther on, I don't know where, a lighthouse shone brilliantly over the waves, and this is all I recollect about this first stage of our journey. At 7 a.m. we disembarked at Korsur, a little town on the eastern side of Zeeland. Here we jumped into a fresh railway, which carried us over a country quite as flat as the plains of Holstein. We had a 3 hours' journey still before reaching the capital of Denmark. My uncle had not closed an eye. In his impatience, I do believe he was pushing the carriage along with his feet. At last, he caught sight of the sea in the distance. "The sound!" he cried. On our left, there was a huge building resembling a hospital. "It is a madhouse," said one of our travelling companions. "Well now," I thought to myself, "that is an establishment we certainly ought to end our days in, and large as it is, it would still be too small to contain all the madness of Professor Lidenbrock." At 10 a.m, we set foot in Copenhagen. The luggage was put on a conveyance, and we drove to the Phoenix Hotel in Breda Gate. This occupied about 30 minutes, for the station was outside the town. There, my uncle, after a brief toilette, dragged me out with him. The porter of the hotel spoke German and English, but the professor, being a perfect polyglot, interrogated him in good Danish, and it was in good Danish that the man directed him to the Museum of Northern Antiquities. The curator of the curious establishment, where a new history of the country might be compiled out of the old stone weapons and bowls and jewels, was Professor Thompson, a savant, and a friend of the consul in Hamburg. My uncle had a warm letter of recommendation to him. As a rule, one savant is not very cordial to another, but here was an exception. Mr. Thompson, being an obliging man, gave Professor Lidenbrock a hearty welcome, and his nephew also. It is hardly necessary to say that we kept our secret from the worthy curator. We were simply visiting Iceland as disinterested amateurs. Mr. Thompson placed himself entirely at our disposal, and ran about the quays for us, trying to find a vessel that was going there. I fervently hoped his search would be unsuccessful, but it was nothing of the sort. A small Danish schooner, the Valkyria, was to sail on the 2nd of June for Reykjavik. The captain, Mr. Bjorn, was on board. His intending passenger almost crushed his hand by the hearty grip he gave it in his joy. The worthy man was a little astonished, for going to Iceland was an everyday occurrence to him. My uncle thought it sublime, and the brave captain took advantage of his enthusiasm to ask him double fare. But we did not look at matters too closely. "Be on board on Sunday at 7 a.m., said Mr. Bjorn, pocketing the dollars coolly as the bargain was concluded. We then returned to the Phoenix after giving our best thanks to Mr. Thompson for his trouble. "This is capital, most capital," repeated my uncle. "What a fortunate chance to have found a ship ready to sail. Now we'll have breakfast and then go and look at the town." We went first to Kongens Nye Tor, an irregular square, where two harmless cannons were posted. Close by, at number 5, there was a French restauration, kept by a cook named Vincent. Here, we breakfasted very well for the modest sum of 4 marks each. Then I wandered about the town with absolutely childish delight. My uncle walked along, but he saw nothing, neither the magnificent palace of the king, nor the pretty bridge built in the 16th century, which stretches across the canal in front of the museum, nor that immense cenotaph of Torvaldsen, adorned with horrible mural paintings outside, and containing in the interior the works of the sculptor, nor the castle of Rosenberg, in a tolerably fine park, a miniature structure looking like a bonbon box, nor the Exchange, a handsome Renaissance edifice, nor its tower, composed of the twisted tails of 4 dragons in bronze, nor the great windmills on the ramparts, the vast sails of which swelled out before the breeze like the canvas of a ship in a breeze. What charming walks my pretty Gräuben and I would have had along the harbour, where the 2-deckers and the frigates sleep peacefully, below the red roof of the shed, and along the verdant banks of the strait, through the leafy shades of which the citadel peeps out, and its black line of cannon stretches along the branches of the elders and willows. But, alas, she was far away, and might I ever hope to see her again? However, though my uncle noticed none of these enchanting views, he was much struck by the sight of a certain steeple in the island of Amak, which forms the southwest quarter of Copenhagen. I was ordered to bend my steps towards it, and hailed a little steamer which ferried passengers over the canal. In a few minutes, we landed on the quay of the dockyard. After having traversed several narrow streets, where the galley slaves, in their yellow and grey short trousers, were toiling under the baton of the sergeants, we came in front of the 4 Frauenskur Kirche. There was nothing remarkable in this church, but this was why the steeple had attracted the attention of the professor.
It was of considerable height, and rising from the top of the tower, there was a staircase outside, which wound round the spire to the very top.
"Let us go up it," said my uncle.
"But it will make us giddy."
"All the more reason for going. We must accustom ourselves to it. But come, I tell you, do not lose time."
I was forced to obey. The man who kept the church lived on the other side of the street, and I got the key from him, and we commenced the ascent. My uncle went first, with a nimble foot. I followed him in some alarm, for I was desperately inclined to turn giddy. I had neither the steadiness nor the nerves of an eagle. As long as we were inside the spiral, I got on well enough, but after 150 steps, I felt the wind on my face, and we reached the platform of the steeple where the outside stair commenced. It was protected by a frail balustrade, and the steps growing narrower and narrower seemed to climb up into space.
"I shall never do it!" I exclaimed. "Would you be a coward?"
"Go on," replied the inexorable professor. I was compelled to obey, clinging with all my might. The strong wind made me giddy. I felt the steeple oscillate at every gust. My legs gave way, and I had to climb up soon on my knees and then on my stomach. I shut my eyes. I felt sick. At last I reached the ball, my uncle dragging me by the collar.
"Look down," he said, "and look well. We must take abyss lessons."
I opened my eyes. I saw the houses, looking flat and as if crushed by a fall, in the midst of thick smoke. Above my head, scattered clouds were passing, and by an optical inversion, they seemed to me motionless, while the steeple and ball and myself were whirling down with fantastic swiftness. In the distance, on one side lay the green plains, and on the other the sparkling sea. The sound spread out before Elsinore, and sundry white sails, like the wings of seabirds, and in the mist, to the east, appeared the faint outlines of the Swedish coast. All the universe was swimming round before my eyes. But for all that, I was obliged to rise, and stand up and gaze. My first lesson in vertigo lasted an hour, and when at last I was allowed to descend, and my feet touched the solid pavement of the street, I was lame.
"We will begin again tomorrow," said my master.
And so we did. For 5 days in succession, this dizzy exercise was repeated, and in spite of myself, I made sensible progress in the art of high contemplation. Chapter 9. The day of departure arrived. Our obliging friend, Mr. Thompson, brought us hearty letters of introduction to Baron Trampa, the governor of Iceland, to Mr. Píktursson, the suffragan of the bishop, and Mr. Finnsson, mayor of Reykjavik, for which my uncle thanked him by the heartiest shake of the hand. On the 2nd, at 6 a.m., our precious luggage was carried on board the Valkyria, and we were conducted to our narrow cabins by the captain.
"Have we a fair wind?"
asked my uncle.
"Excellent," replied Captain Bjorn. "A sou'wester. We shall go out of the sound in full sail."
A few minutes later the schooner got under way, and with her mizzen, brigantine, and t'gallant sail spread, was running before the breeze through the strait. An hour afterwards, the capital of Denmark seemed to sink beneath the distant waves, and the Valkyria was coasting along by Elsinore. In my excited, nervous state, I expected to see the ghost of Hamlet wandering on the legendary terrace. "Sublime madman," I said to myself. "You would approve our proceedings, undoubtedly. Maybe you would follow us to the center of the globe, to seek there a solution of your eternal doubt." But nothing appeared on those ancient walls. The castle, moreover, is much younger than the heroic Prince of Denmark.
It is used now as a sumptuous lodge for the tollkeeper of the Sound, through which 15,000 vessels of all nations pass every year. The castle of Kronsberg soon vanished in the mist, as also the town of Helsingborg on the Swedish coast, and the schooner began to catch the breezes of the Kattegat. The Valkyria was a good sailor, but one cannot reckon on a sailing vessel. She was loaded with coal for Reykjavik, and household utensils, earthenware, woolen clothing, and a cargo of wheat. 5 men, all Danes, composed the crew. "How long will the voyage take?" my uncle asked the captain. "About 10 days," was the reply, "if we don't get a taste of Nor'wester as we pass the Faroes." "But as a rule, are you liable to be much delayed?" "No, Mr. Lidenbrock. Make your mind easy. We'll get there soon enough." Towards evening, the schooner doubled the Skagen, the northern point of Denmark, and during the night we passed through the Skeie Rack, coasted along the extremity of Norway by Cape Lindness and out into the North Sea. 2 days afterwards we sighted the coast of Scotland off Peterhead, and the Valkyria began to steer straight towards the Faroe Islands, passing between the Orkneys and Shetlands. The waves of the Atlantic were soon dashing against our schooner, and she had to tack to avoid the north wind, and had considerable difficulty in getting to the Faroes. On the 8th, the captain sighted Myganness, the most easterly of the islands, and from that time steered a straight course for Portland Bay, situated on the southern coast of Iceland. Nothing particular occurred during the passage. I stood the sea pretty well, but my uncle, to his great vexation and still greater shame, was ill the whole time. He was unable, consequently, to have any conversation with the captain about Snare Fell and the means of communication with it or modes of transport. All these questions he was obliged to postpone till his arrival, and passed his time lying down in his cabin, the sides of which cracked and shivered with the pitching of the vessel. It must be owned, he rather deserved his fate. On the 11th we sighted Cape Portland. The weather happening to be clear just then allowed us a glimpse of Myrdalsjökull, which rises above it. The cape is simply a low, broad hill with very steep sides, standing alone on the shore. The Valkyria kept a good way out from the coast in a westerly direction, sailing through numerous shoals of whales and sharks. Presently, an immense rock was seen, pierced with holes, through which the foaming waves dashed furiously. The Westman Islets seemed to rise out of the ocean like rocks strewed on the liquid plain. After this, the schooner made a wide sweep to round Cape Reykjanes, which forms the western angle of Iceland. The stormy sea prevented my uncle from coming on deck to admire the broken, jagged shores, constantly beat upon by gales from the southwest. 48 hours later, just as we got out of a storm which obliged the schooner to take in every inch of canvas, we sighted in the east the beacon light of Cape Skagen, whose dangerous rocks extend a great distance below the waves. An Iceland pilot came on board, and 3 hours afterwards the Valkyria moored before Reykjavik in the Faxa Bay. The professor emerged from his cabin at last, a little pale and exhausted, but as enthusiastic as ever, his eyes beaming with satisfaction. The inhabitants of the town stood in a group on the quay, peculiarly interested in the arrival of a vessel which had brought everyone's commissions. My uncle was all haste to leave his floating prison, or we might say hospital, but before leaving the deck of the schooner he dragged me away to the bow, and pointing with his finger to the mouth of the bay, showed me a high mountain with 2 peaks, a double cone covered with eternal snows. "Snare Fell! Snare Fell!" he exclaimed, thus reminding me by a gesture to keep silence, he took his seat in the boat, which was waiting for us. I followed, and our feet soon touched the shores of Iceland. Next minute, a fine-looking man appeared in the uniform of a general. However, he was simply a magistrate, the governor of Iceland, Baron Trampe himself. The professor speedily discovered his rank and presented him with his letters of introduction from Copenhagen. Then followed a brief conversation in Danish, which I did not understand a word of, and for a good reason. But the outcome of it all was that Baron Trampe placed himself entirely at the disposal of Professor Liddenbrock. From the mayor, Mr. Finson, no less military in costume than the governor, and equally pacific in temper and calling, my uncle received a most kindly welcome. The bishop's suffragan, Mr. Pique Tuerson, was making an episcopal visitation in the north, so we had to give up, meantime, the pleasure of being introduced to him. But there was one most fascinating man we met with, whose society became very precious to me. This was Mr. Fridrikson, professor of natural science in the school at Reykjavik. This modest savant only spoke Icelandic and Latin. It was in the soft tongue of Horace that he came to offer his services, and I felt at home with him at once. In fact, he was the only person with whom I could exchange a word during my stay in Iceland. Out of the three rooms which his house contained, this excellent man placed two at our disposal, and soon we were installed in them, bag and baggage, the quantity of which rather astonished the good folks of Reykjavik. "Come now, Axel," said my uncle. "We are getting on famously. The worst part of the business is over." "How do you make that out?" I exclaimed. "Why, all we have to do now is to make the descent." "Oh, well, if you look at it in that way, you are right. But we have got to get up as well as to get down, I fancy." "Oh, that does not trouble me at all. Come, there is no time to lose. I'm going to the library. Perhaps there is some manuscript of Saknussemm's to be found there, and I should like very much to consult it. And while you are there, I will look over the town. Won't you do that much, too?" "Oh, that has but little interest for me. The most curious part of Iceland is not what is on the surface, but what is below." I went out and wandered at haphazard. It would have been difficult to lose one's way in Reykjavik, seeing there are but two streets, so I was not obliged to ask my way by making signs, which exposes one to many mistakes. The town lies between two hills, on a somewhat low and marshy soil. An immense layer of lava covers it on one side and slopes gently down to the sea. The wide bay of Faxa stretches out on the opposite side and is bounded by the enormous Snæfell glacier. And in this bay, the Valkyria was the only vessel then at anchor. Generally, the English and French fishery keepers are moored in the offing, but just now they were wanted on the eastern coast of the island. The longer of the two streets lies parallel with the shore. It is here that the merchants and traders live in wooden huts, made of red planks laid horizontally. The other street, more to the west, runs down to a little lake, between the houses of the bishop and others not connected with trade. I had soon made my way through these dull, melancholy-looking streets, here and there catching a glimpse of a bit of faded turf, like an old threadbare carpet, or occasionally of a garden, the scanty produce of which, consisting of a few potatoes, cabbages, and lettuces, might have easily figured on a Lilliputian table. A few sickly gillyflowers were also trying to lift up their heads in the sunlight. About the center of the non-commercial street, I found the public cemetery, enclosed by a mud wall, and apparently with plenty of room in it. A few steps farther brought me to the governor's house, a hut compared with the town hall of Hamburg, though a palace beside the huts of the Icelanders. A church rose between the little lake and the town, built in the Protestant style, and with calcined stones, which the volcanoes brought up from the earth at their own expense. When strong gales blew from the southwest, it was evident that the red tiles of the roofs would be scattered in all directions, to the great danger of the faithful worshippers. On a neighbouring eminence, I perceived the National School, where, as I was subsequently informed by our host, Hebrew, English, French, and Danish are taught, four languages of which, I am ashamed to say, I didn't know a single word. I should have stood at the bottom of the class in the little college numbering 40 scholars and been unworthy to sleep with them in one of those double closets where more delicate boys must have died of suffocation on the very first night.